Hi, everybody. Quentin here from Modo. We're sat with Ed Porter from Invinity, a good friend, and we've been wanting to get him on for a while. So thanks for coming in, Ed. Ed, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm on day two of the Solar Room Storage Conference, so I'm feeling, I'd say, 50% exhausted.
So you've got 3 days, so by tomorrow you're probably going to be at zero.
Yeah.
Oh, 100%.
100% exhausted, and then Thursday is a lighter day.
Yeah. Ed, want to get straight to it. You know a lot about batteries, flow batteries, and your experience in dispatchable power, so peakers, across the whole energy landscape. So if you want to start, can you just tell us a little bit more about where you've worked up until now and what you've seen, and then we're going to talk loads about flow batteries today. But yeah, before we can talk about flow batteries, where have you been before this, and what do you know?
What do I know? Yeah, great question. Don't ask my team, the answer might be not very much. But my kind of career to date, I think, tracks a little bit of what the energy industry's done. So I started off at RWE on their graduate scheme. So I would have been looking at things like Aberthaw, coal-based generation within RWE, and then moving through that, going from RWE, looking at things like CMA and EMR back in 2012, then moved to Gazprom Marketing and Trading, which is much more of a gas and power type thing. So if you're moving from coal to gas, and then from Gazprom, a complete change to what was then Red Sea Energy and is now Invinity Energy Systems. Looking at flow batteries, and so I think quite nicely sort of does the transition that we're all looking at in terms of coal to gas to future net zero tech. So that's my history in a nutshell.
So you're right at the other end now.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think coal, it's still, coal power stations are a pretty incredible technology.
Yeah. I remember going to Ratcliffe when I was sort of much younger, as a student, and just the size and the scale of it is incredible. Anyone who's been to Ratcliffe, or you can go to Sellenge, or you used to be able to go to Sellenge, and go and have a look at some of the major equipment in some of these installations, it's really worth the trip. And it's, if you're a bit of an energy nerd, it's kind of like a great place to go.
It's incredible. I mean, as an aside, one thing that blew my mind was that the coal is like a powder. It's like a dust powder that they inject the coal. It's not like your barbecue briskets. It's injected like a liquid, and then they burn it. Anyway, we're talking about coal. We're not here to talk about coal. So flow batteries. We'll talk about Invinity in a second. But flow batteries. What are flow batteries? And because there's a lot of, most people come across lithium ion. Now's the chance. What does a flow battery do, and why is it awesome?
Yeah, so flow batteries, the reason why a flow battery is interesting is because what we are using within the flow battery is vanadium, and vanadium dissolved in a liquid. That vanadium can then be stable across four states, so vanadium 2 to vanadium 5. The reason why that's interesting is because you can essentially charge and discharge that vanadium to put it into any of those states, and it will stay there. It's not going to decide to do something else. It's not going to degrade with time. It's just going to stay there until you need to use it again. So what that gives you is something that's essentially an infinitely reusable electrolyte. And that means that you can have unlimited or warranted unlimited cycles. So you can just keep on going with that system. You can use it 4 times a day. You can use it 5 times a day. The temperature starts to move around a bit, no problem. Off you go. Use it again. It's really high throughput tech, and you don't degrade it in use. So you then get to the end of that life, say 20 years, and you've still got that electrolyte. That vanadium that you put into the system in the beginning has gone nowhere. You can still use it. You can take it back out. You can turn it into vanadium. You can put it into a new system.
Ed, what is vanadium?
Vanadium is a metal. I think it is the 13th most common element. That's pub quiz knowledge.
Certainly,
I think.
Invinity, it's one of the most common.
Within our factory, it's probably the most common. The reason why people might know...
No, it's a metal, but it's a liquid.
It's a metal.
Right.
And it comes primarily in sort of vanadium trioxide and vanadium pentoxide, which is an exciting fact. But those two are generally used within steel manufacturing. So, on your cutlery at home, you might have sort of 0.something% of vanadium in your steel. So it's used to harden steel. That's why
in my solid silver cutlery at home.
Sorry, I forgot you have solid silver cutlery at home. Yeah. So you won't have any, but for those, you know, those listening in a more normal kitchen. So anyway, it's primarily used in steel and it is mined sort of pretty much all over the world. Vanadium is not really used at scale in flow batteries today, but obviously it's something that the industry is quite excited about. And so you see people like the Bushvelds, the Largos, the Glencores of this world, who do mine it, are, you know, always very interested in kind of what's happening in the market, because, you know, they would love to see vanadium flow batteries kind of be a bigger portion of energy storage.
So just take a step back here. So vanadium flow batteries are big energy storage systems, just like these, you know, containers full of lithium ion batteries. I'm not going to do all the comparisons to lithium ion, but a lot of the guys watching this will be used to that. So it's still batteries in containers. It's just a different type of battery that has some benefits over other types of batteries, and obviously some cons too, which we'll talk about later. But to get to frame this, we're still talking about grid connected energy storage. How big are these systems?
So, yes, we're still talking about grid-connected energy storage systems. We are also talking about sort of behind-the-meter energy storage systems. So a typical 20-foot container for us is 78 kilowatts, 220 kilowatt hours. So that is that's just your standard 20-foot container. That's not high-cubed. And then you can stack that. So you can stack that to two high. And
by the way, 20 foot is about half the size of a lot of the traditional containers folks see in UK, right?
Yeah, so people
need to double those numbers to
People will be familiar with the 40-foot shipping containers, and then having seen a few lithium sites, kind of what you then see is you'll see sort of the PCS, or you'll see the HVAC kind of stuck on the end of that. So you'll see a 40-foot plus for the lithium installations. Okay. Nice things about vanadium flow. So we talked about the non-degradation in cycling. That's a really important thing, and it also means you have
zero degradation.
It's completely stable in from 2 to 5 in terms of its state of charge, and you just don't degrade it in use. So that electrolyte is as good at 20 years is at 0 years.
So the cost of a cycle
doesn't include any degradation. It's only the other costs.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool.
So you have that warranty. That warranty of unlimited cycles, that's really important. And you have this end of life value that is fundamentally different to lithium. We could talk about lithium recycling, but I think that's a tangent maybe. And then the other sides of it are that because it is dissolved in a liquid and that liquid is non-flammable, you don't have thermal runaway risk, which is a change from your lithium systems that you'd be familiar with. We are an electrochemical battery, so we can do we've been doing FFR since 2019. So you can do all the way down to the single second.
Because everyone always talks about flow, like flow is long duration and lithium is for frequency response, right?
Yeah.
And of course, and so it sounds like that's not the case. So where have you been doing FFR?
We've been doing FFR on a CNI site in the south of England. That's been working away.
Is that an Invinity one or Red T one?
That was a Red T system. It was actually a Gen 2 system. We went through a merger. We were on our Gen 3 system, and the people we merged with were also kind of on Gen 3 system. And our next system, adding Gen 3 to Gen 3, has ended up with us calling our next thing a VS3, which is also...
What's a Gen 3?
A Generation 3. Okay. Generation. So it's kind of like...
You had two versions before this one. Okay, let's talk about... So you were at Red T.
Yes.
Red T's... Does Red T still exist? Is it still a brand? Or
No. Okay. Red T.
So what's happened there?
Red T merged with a company called Avalon in Canada, based in Vancouver, and that has become Invinity. And so the whole company has become Invinity.
And how big is this company? So
this company is about 150 people.
Okay.
I would say we have about 25 megawatt hours running in the field at the moment. And recently we just raised $25 million for scaling up with an additional kind of X amount on an open offer, and then there are some what people would call warrants that then work with that scale us up as we deliver stuff over the next few years. So yeah, it's definitely a growing business.
And where do they make these? So where does the vanadium How big are the tanks? Let's get some scale here, right? So we talked about 20-foot containers. Do you need two tanks of liquid and you move it between the tanks?
Yeah, this is a good question. And I think this is I'll talk about how it's configured in a second.
Okay, cool.
I think the first question is maybe one you didn't ask, but I think is an important one, which is to talk about how people are coping with the whole COVID and supply chain piece.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think, you know, we as a business, we do a lot of our high IP stuff with either within Vancouver, or we do it within Bathgate, small town outside of Edinburgh. And we have a factory there. And that does sort of the high IP type stuff. So you're talking about control, you're talking about power electronics, you're talking about commissioning, testing, R&D type work, the fundamental stacks. So that's our part of the system that allows you to charge and discharge. Mm-hmm. is the stack. And then we also have a lot of sort of standard components, so pumps, pipes, and the fundamental shipping container, and we get those from all around the world. That global model is great. And then COVID comes along, and it turns out it's really hard to do some of that stuff within the last year. So I have a great admiration for the people who have worked in supply chain over the last year. I don't think there's been anything like it. I think they have dealt with a sort of once in a lifetime problem. And the fact that we as a business, but also many others, are able to come out and say, hey, we actually delivered something within this time when there weren't shipping containers and boats were getting cancelled. And no one was allowing, you know, looking at the lithium guys, you know, no one's allowing dangerous goods onto ships. Yeah. How do you do this? How do you get anything done? And so people who've worked in supply chain in the last year, I think, yeah, have my admiration. It's certainly much, much harder job than working in commercial.
Yeah, it sounds it. It feels like we sort of run around from these extremes, like the bottlenecks right now are connections, right? And then supply chain. And it feels like this is why our industry is so young. Because we just go from extremes firefighting, trying to get around these square peg round hole problems, which just don't fit.
Yeah.
Let's come back to the technology for a second. So a flow battery works by moving liquid around between two tanks or three tanks?
Two tanks.
So we've got a big tank here. We move the vanadium inner liquid around through a thing.
Through a stack.
Yeah. And that produces electricity, or it charges...
Exactly. So we essentially have two tanks of vanadium electrolyte. We pump those past a stack which contains a membrane. You then run a voltage across that to charge or discharge your vanadium. You then have vanadium in different states of charge. And then depending on what that state of charge is, you can bring that back in and either charge or discharge further.
Okay, I understand.
That's the kind of nuts and bolts of it. And if you were to say, how does it look at a very simple degree, it is just... small tanks underneath those stacks at the top, and a pump in between.
And the fluid. So you say there's no thermal runaway. Is it flammable? This fluid, or is it
not flammable? Not flammable. More likely to put something out than it is to start. So it is dissolved in acid. So it's very similar to say a car battery in terms of acidity. So that's something we often talk about when we're planning a site. Everything is double bonded, which means it's kind of got two tanks to protect it from any kind of issue there. So
that kind of thing.
Yeah. On the whole, of issues with tech, I think the safety side is definitely a stronger point for us over sort of adjacent techs like lithium. Okay. I'm kind of very hesitant to sort of say that we compete with lithium because I actually don't think we do. I think we're sort of complementary techs to each other. I think lithium does a really good job in ancillary services and 1 to 2 hour storage, addressing that sort of that large peak. And it is the go-to option today for storage to deal with what the grid needs. I don't think it is going to be the go-to option for all storage to deliver a 2035 net zero system. And I think we're going to get other solutions. And taking the sort of Invinity hat off for a moment, there are lots of ways of doing that. You could have abated CCGTs, you could have hydrogen in peakers, you could have medium to longer duration storage, you could build more pump storage, you could have very flexible demand, you know, everyone plugging in their Tesla type thing. There's lots of ways of doing it, and I just don't think lithium's going to be the one that ticks off all of those boxes. And I don't think anyone really expects it to.
No, no.
And so we kind of see ourselves on that kind of sliding scale between what might be this kind of shorter duration today in terms of the lithium, and then at some point you need a longer duration of your cycling, but you also need more cycles, and that's kind of where we see ourselves in the market.
Can we talk for a second about projects that that Flow is working on right now, or yeah. I say Flow, that you're working on with Flow batteries, mm-hmm. and what's the vision here? How ready is this technology?
Yeah.
Are we ready to deploy at scale? And orders are now coming in for this kind of technology. You know, people are putting their money where their mouth is, which is great. What does the next 10 years look like?
Yeah,
there's a lot of questions there.
So. Yeah. That's a real that was a buy one get one free, wasn't it? So what are we doing today? So we have just delivered the last systems to Energy Superhub Oxford, which is a project with Pivot Power that became EDF. They still are Pivot Power, but now they're owned by EDF. That's a really exciting project. That is a 50 megawatt grid connection that has. They've split that 50 megawatts between a lithium system and a 2 megawatt, 5 megawatt hour flow system that's on site. So that for us was a great chance to demonstrate our technology. It was all funded by Innovate and the PIFA grant that was 2018, 2019.
Yep.
And that's been a really, really good opportunity to kind of put tech on the ground and show what it can do. And that will go into the balancing mechanism, that will go into wholesale markets. You know, 2 years ago, I would have said that's going to go into FFR and it's going to do some clever things with the lithium. But the way FFR is going in terms of DC, DR, DM, I think there's now a much more appropriate market for flow in terms of DR. Looks to be, you know, a pre-fault mechanism that's demanding high throughput with a longer duration. It sounds very much like what Flow would like to do.
Just to comment on that, it's probably worth anyone who's watching, you know, there's some awesome media photos, all sorts about that project. It's been really well covered. And we'll put some links in the comments, but do check it out. There's some very pretty looking batteries there.
Absolutely. And I've got loads on my phone. So as long as I send you the right ones and you don't get lots of dog pictures, then you'll have some good content for the website.
Okay, brilliant.
I also, as a tangent, I have some good. I was talking about the vanadium in its dissolved state. I've got some good photos of that as well. Which, if you were to imagine a sort of see-through or glass flow battery, I would love the idea just to kind of see as the vanadium sort of changes state, you see different colours as the charge and discharge happens. And
we'll see whether we can do that. I mean, yeah. We're going to get these photos on the links, or maybe we'll edit them into the. They'll be here somewhere. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
And dog photos, maybe.
And dog, right. Well, maybe.
Yeah. what have we even talked about? I can't remember. Okay, let's talk about long
projects.
Oh, projects.
So it's an ESO.
More round than me.
ESO. So that's been delivered, and we'll be sharing lots of photos. We'll be sharing lots of data. Really excited that we're working with Pivot Power, Wattzilla, and Habitat on that. So, yeah, that's really exciting. That's a real sort of blueprint project for us. At the same time, we've also delivered systems to Scottish Water at their Perth site, and that is a sort of very, very standard behind the meter model. We are oversizing the solar that's on their site, which means kind of just building slightly more than you would do on just a standalone solar project. And then we're also putting storage on. That storage then prevents any excess from going onto the grid and holds that for that sort of typical 4 to 7 peak pricing window. And for what that does for Scottish Water is it allows them to meet more of their load from on-site generation. So it's all part of that net zero play.
Okay.
And we're seeing more and more people be really interested in this. It's a difficult thing to get right, but we've been looking at it for a while. So I think that on the behind the meter side will be a really popular thing in coming years. We're also getting a lot of people looking asking a question saying, I would actually really like to get some EV chargers. And I've asked my DNO, and the DNO says they can't do it by next week. So,
yeah.
Surprise. And then the question comes in and says, well, actually, could we get some storage in to do something? And so we're starting to see some use cases for flow as a kind of distributed energy storage tech.
This sounds like a very complicated Excel sheet with a business case on it. It's hard enough to build a business case, but I'm sure perhaps it works, and perhaps it's brilliant.
Yeah.
I just wouldn't want to be the guy putting the case
and this is I suppose that's an interesting part of this, right? Is that if I talk to my parents about what energy storage does, you know, ultimately it's just sort of takes the renewables and shifts it to somewhere else, and it's just very, very simple stuff. And then you talk to anyone who's been in the industry for a while, and they tell you about the sort of 27, 28 ancillary service streams plus the others that are coming, and then you know, the day ahead, OTC day ahead, 200 day markets, and then maybe, you know, put it into the balancing mechanism, and and then the XL model starts to fail somewhat. So I think you can get sort of bogged down in the complexity of it. With the sort of behind the meter model, it really is quite a simple thing of solar's really valuable right now for anyone doing net zero, anyone looking to save costs. And so play that card, build solar on your site, definitely. And if you have space, oversize it and get some sort of storage in to kind of reap the rewards of that cheap solar build. It is something actually that, sorry, we're going off topic, but it's a question that I've been asked a lot, right? Which is, and it's true for solar and it's true for storage. So people often say, why would I buy this technology today, given it's going to be cheaper tomorrow? Great question. I'll wait till tomorrow. And the answer is that in 10 years' time, everything will be cheaper, but the revenue you get from these things will be considerably lower.
Scaled down, yeah.
So today, you can buy this thing, it's more expensive, but your revenue is very good. And you can see that with dynamic containment from this year. And you can see it with the wholesale prices that you can see in the market. If you then were to build, say, solar in 10, 15 years, there's no guarantee that you're going to be offsetting a really good unit rate. That might have shifted. You know, you might be paying a connection cost and a peak demand charge and not a sort of all-in unit rate that you do today. And so I would sort of advocate to people who are looking to do this kind of thing, who are going, oh, why don't we just wait until tomorrow? The answer is that you can do, and it might be cheaper tomorrow, but your business case might be worse. So it's a... we've gone off on a tangent there. We were talking about ESO.
Well, there's also while we're on this, we don't really have tomorrow, right? If we assume that building this sort of technology is reducing CO2 emissions, there is no tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
I know everything needs to be investable, and we've got hurdle rates, and isn't it all very boring? No, I'm only joking, but there is no tomorrow.
It's a really good point, right? So yesterday, I was on this this session talking about mechanisms for encouraging longer duration storage to come to market. Yeah. And people were saying, oh, should we go for cap and floor? Should we go for regulated asset base? There are lots of other, you know, higher carbon prices, or should we maybe derate the capacity market returns based on the carbon intensity of the tech that sits within it? Lots of kind of good and interesting ideas. And then I had sort of various people kind of come up to me afterwards and go, well, you know, that's not a perfect mechanism. And it's like, well, it might not be perfect, but if you're going to try and do all this stuff by 2035, if we sit around and talk for 10 years, we're screwed. Yeah. Like, we haven't got a chance. So at some point, someone needs to go, okay, this isn't perfect, but this is good enough, and this is going to get us to where we need to get to. And I don't think when people did EMR and CM and CFDs back in 2012, I don't think they were sitting there going, oh, this is, you know, we've got the perfect solution here. People always said CM was a sticking plaster, and yet here it is, kind of underpinning most business cases that we see today. So...
And we are definitely going off on a tangent now, but fortune favours the brave, because the folks who built energy storage in 2016, 2017, who couldn't make it add up really on an Excel sheet, but believed in the macro picture, believed in flexibility, believed in the idea of being able to dispatch whenever you want, those folks have already made pretty good money, right?
I hear a lot of people saying, just if only there was a leaderboard that could show me how well everyone was doing. Yeah,
I wish everyone would plug us just like this on the pocket. Okay, right. So let's come back to what we're talking about. So longer duration storage.
Yeah.
At the moment, what does longer duration storage mean? Like, how long is longer duration? And is there a market for longer duration storage? Yeah. And what's going to happen?
Yeah.
Because you watch this very closely, I'm
good,
sure.
Yeah, good question. So the definition of long / longer duration storage is an interesting one. So I think long duration storage, genuinely long duration storage, is probably, you're talking interweek, you might be talking seasonal, you might be talking, you're trying to address... I think fundamentally you're trying to address the heating imbalance between seasons, and you're trying to address the problems that come with having wind cycles. So your wind cycle might be, say, 1 to 4 weeks. So you're trying to get around those issues. Longer duration storage is anything longer than gets built commercially in the market today. Now, I think Bayes is minded to position for defining what storage means is anything longer than 4 hours, but that is probably reasonably fair for something that is longer than what is being built today. You know, most lithium systems you're seeing are sort of 1 to 2, possibly 2.5, but I don't think anyone's really building beyond that. So that is kind of what's what those definitions mean. In terms of what the business case is for those, the business case today is for power is for power focused systems. So it's for that sort of 1 to 2 hour duration.
Megawatt, not megawatt hour, right? That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, you're sort of, I don't know, 10 megawatt, 20 megawatt hour. I think you're seeing you'll see a lot of stuff built in the next couple of years that is sort of between 50 and 100 megawatts and 100 megawatt hours to 200 megawatt yes. hours. You know, that's the kind of sweet spot. And I think, you know, just talking to people who've been at solar and storage, there's definitely a you know, big chunk of people who are seeing a huge number of those projects being built. So that's good. You know, flying the flag for net zero and transition, like, it's just great to see it happening. Is there a business case beyond that in today's market? I personally think that there will be. And I think that there is a recognition that there is value to be brought by longer duration storage techs, and that if you have on one side your short duration techs and on your other side you have your abated CCGTs and you have your hydrogen peakers, that in between there's an undefined amount of value that other storage techs can bring to that market. And that doesn't necessarily mean Invinity, but that means kind of all flow batteries or all sort of medium to long duration storage techs. How much of that pie can they really be? And I think that's a really interesting question, because at the moment, the kind of assumption is from government that we're going to get these sort of clusters, the carbon capture storage clusters, and we're going to get this amount of hydrogen. It's just going to happen.
Yep.
It's not sort of economically driven. It's just going to happen. And on this side, we've got ancillary services that have pushed a big amount of lithium and provide a lot of sort of peaking services. And the question is there value from these longer duration storage assets? And if the answer is there is value from them, then I think we'll see mechanisms emerge to encourage them to come to market.
So how would this work, right? So when do you buy the power? When do you sell it?
So it's a very standard business case, to the extent that pumped hydro has been doing this for years. You know, it's not so much a...
In fact, some folks even talk about pumping hours, right? You see some old timers in our industry. They talk about ether blocks being pumping hours, which I absolutely love. But yeah, sorry, digress.
And the kind of emergence of pumped hydro is an interesting thing to look at. You know, back in the days of a board and pool pricing type thing. You know, you go back a little bit of time, you find out that not everything's always been built on the back of a discounted cash flow model. So how do they operate is a really interesting question. I think that medium and longer duration storage works more like that traditional pumped hydro, where they're not, say, targeting a particular half hour. More their dispatch is based around having a bid and offer price that they're comfortable with and providing that constantly. In a similar way to pre-fault dynamic regulation, they're providing that service constantly to the balancing markets.
Drip feeding across the day into the BM National Grid needs it.
Exactly. So as soon as National Grid needs it, National Grid can call it. It sort of acts very much like a dampener on energy balancing needs. I think with the lithium side, you just need to be a little bit more careful with your warranties and opportunity costs, because with a 1 hour system, your opportunity cost is slightly higher. With a longer duration system, you're more happy to be available. And you do see pumped hydro do this. Pumped hydro just sits in the BM and occupies a position and says, look, if you need me, let me know and I'll sort of step in. And I think medium to long duration storage will serve that same role.
Yeah. I guess if you've got a longer duration system, I'm probably gonna say something out of turn here, but your optimization problem is probably a bit simpler. Right, because if you're timing an hour system, if some of these aren't even an hour, like the 50 minutes or something, everything comes down to your forecasting capabilities, basically, doesn't it? Like, when are you going to pull the trigger? And you miss the peak, and technically you're in big trouble, especially when you've got, you're working on behalf of an investor who is going to point a finger at you if you get it slightly wrong, which I feel really bad. Well, the optimizers in this world have got a very difficult job right now. But yeah, if with a longer duration system, if you can just sort of sit in a BM and give power, export when National Grid needs you, it's nice. The problem is that market isn't that way of operating. That market doesn't have space for. I'm hesitant to put a number on it, but it's not that big a market, right? Mm. It's gigawatts, but it's not tens and tens of gigawatts.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thing, right? So we talk about. We talk about, say, lithium and sort of short duration storage being sort of making massive strides, and we talk about it going to, say, being a 2 gigawatt, 4 gigawatt hour portfolio, and that's exciting. But 4 gigawatt hours, if you think about, say, like a Pembroke power station, a 2 gigawatt CCGT, you run that for 2 hours, you're at 4 gigawatt hours. You've done it. One station does exactly the same energy that comes out of every single lithium thing that's been built to date to create this kind of 2 gigawatt, 4 gigawatt hour the portfolio. And people will be jumping up and down about that, saying that they're not the same. And I know that they're definitely not the same. But just I'm just trying to draw out the scale comparison. That there is a huge need for storage to be shifted, and it's kind of easy to kind of get drawn into this idea that we're always record breaking in terms of how big our storage systems are, but in reality, the energy shifting that needs to be done between seasons is a huge challenge.
Yeah. It's maybe 100x. Which is crazy. Okay, I want to talk for a second about building flow batteries. Okay. So, how does one build a flow battery? I am a developer. I own some land and I've got a grid connection. I'm probably one of the few people out there right now.
Yeah.
This is not me personally, but hypothetically, I'm a person who does this. And I'm thinking about energy storage and I'm thinking about flow.
Mm-hmm.
How do I go about building that? I guess I need to get planning permission. Do I get a different type of planning permission? Do I need a different type of grid connection? Do I have to go to different types of investors? How would it work for me, Joe Bloggs, who wants to make this happen?
Yeah, good question. So first things first, you would definitely call up your sort of friendly vanadium flow battery company. They would provide you with some information. But the kind of joking aside, I think it's a very straightforward process, very, very similar to kind of what you would see with lithium today. So a lot of it is based around that planning and connection agreement.
Okay.
And provided you've got planning, connection agreement and sort of access to the site, you're pretty much good to go.
Yep.
You obviously need some civils in terms of concrete plinths. That's very similar to what you'd have for lithium. You don't have that fire risk element, so you can stack things in a slightly different way. But to be honest, it's a very straightforward installation process. So we'll bring those systems down, crane them in, and then it's a couple of weeks for a site to get the whole thing plugged in, running, commissioned, and then you're good to go.
And how much space do I need? Let's use the magical 50 megawatt site. Actually, we need to talk about megawatt hours, don't we? So let's say 50 megawatts. What's a normal duration? Let's say 4 hours.
Yeah, let's say 4 hours. And I'm a little bit useless with sort of acres and hectares. So I'd apologise to any farmers listening or people familiar with kind of that sort of land spacing.
Or you can talk about football pitches, which again, I don't really know.
Yeah.
How many car parking spaces? Maybe? So, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question. Maybe the way to answer it is to talk about a comparison. So with the lithium systems that I've seen and the flow systems that I've seen from an energy perspective, comparing energy to energy, you're looking at around about 1.5 to 2 times the space to get a flow system.
Land space,
yeah.
That's not so bad, actually. I thought it would be higher.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of a very common thing to be sort of talked about. And I think part of the reason is because if you buy your best lithium cell and you liquid cool it, or you have it in your phone or your laptop, and you compare that to an all-in installation of flow, you go, oh God, this looks like it's so much more energy dense. But in reality, the lithium sites, like all power sites, have sort of the rules and regulations of how they can be set up, how they should be structured. And so you do end up at around about that sort of 1.5 to 2% sort of size of,
because you need to put space between containers, you need air between things, you still need the balance of plants, you need to get forklifts in and all that stuff. Yeah,
exactly. So you know, we do find that's a problem. Let's say you wanted to do something within central London. I personally don't think that's where you're going to see flow batteries deployed.
I'm sat on 100 acres in central London.
Yeah.
I wonder what to do with it.
I'd recommend building a palace and moving the royals in. We do see space constraints as a problem. The flip side to that is the kind of lack of the lack of kind of thermal runaway. And so where sometimes you have where space is a premium, but they are concerned about that sort of safety side, then flow can be a very nice fit into those applications. So it really does sort of come on a case by case basis. it is probably a good time to talk about the kind of other systems out there. And you do have a kind of, you know, like Invinity don't stand alone in the kind of flow battery space. There's lots of other people out there with lots of other solutions. I think we are quite energy dense when it comes to flow. Some other manufacturers out there with different techs, so non-vanadium techs, have much bigger space requirements.
Oh, because there's other flow batteries out there other than Invinity, right?
Exactly. And so there's kind of zinc bromide, molten salt, iron flow. And there's kind of lots of other ways of doing it. And the nice thing with vanadium is that you have everything is vanadium, so you don't get any kind of crossover, and it's all completely stable, so you don't get any kind of degradation. Other techs, there are sort of differences within that. But there's also a difference on energy density. And so some of the numbers we've seen today around some of these really big build-outs that in the US have raised a huge amount of money, it's kind of interesting to see, because you kind of, in my experience of looking at these sites, it's rare that you will find someone who goes, actually, you know what, space isn't a constraint, you know. And that means that you're building in a desert, perhaps.
In the outback, or in Australia or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is a good use case, but it is limited. And so it's interesting to kind of see how those techs are valued. And I kind of, for me, when I look into that sort of, you know, Pandora's box of future techs that are going to come to market, I would advise people to do one thing, and that is to look at what is actually going into the ground, deployable and demonstrable. And if you can see real things going in and being built, that means that they have got right manufacturing, testing, certificates, supply chain. They've got, you know, directors who are familiar with the process of getting this stuff on the ground, and they have done it, and they have done the transportation, they've done the commissioning. You know, this whole amazing
and it made lots of mistakes.
And it made lots of mistakes. and it's just hugely difficult to do the kind of first ones of these projects. And by doing them and by running them, you're showing a level of kind of readiness, commercial readiness, that I think a lot of, I see a lot of battery technologies, and I get sent a lot of people always send me something and say, oh, look at this, you've got a new person doing this, and it's interesting. I'm actually pro everyone, because there's a huge scale and there's a huge challenge that needs to get addressed. And you know what, if someone comes along tomorrow and says, hey, we've got a system just like yours, except it's half the price, and they can show that it is, then that's great. Like, let's go and do it. Let's go and push it, and we can do sort of net zero in a quicker way. I'm all for that. But there is a kind of right now, look at the systems that are being built, see how well they're working. That's a really good indicator of how ready that business is to actually deliver something for you.
Okay. Two more questions, and I know both are going to be close to your heart. So number one, this is a bit of a naughty question, but
okay.
So is flow the silver bullet for dispatchable solar?
Ooh. So good question. We are actually doing a DC coupled 2 MW, 8 MWh solar and flow system in Australia.
What do you mean by DC coupled?
For folks
at home? Is anybody watching this at home? Wherever you're watching this.
Yeah, on your Friday dinner with your fish and chips. Yeah, I don't think so. I think that DC coupled means that easy to talk about the other way around. So AC coupled is your standard configuration. So that is an inverter per piece of power electronics that you've got per storage thing that you have. You then connect everything up on an AC line, and then you run it through your transformer and put it into your grid. Kind of a setup that we're all quite familiar with. DC is a much perhaps more complicated thing. But you don't run through that inverter. So your DC power that you have at your battery storage, you are running directly into your other thing. So in this case, your other thing is PV. So PV, you take your DC from your PV, you run that directly into your flow battery, and then the combination of those two goes through an inverter.
So your solar panels generate power, you send that power straight to your battery, and it doesn't go through the inverter into grid. You do that before, all behind the inverter. So the idea is you get more efficient.
Exactly. So your typical inverter might be 95 to 97% efficient. And if you're going from your solar to your storage, back through your inverter to go to your grid, you're losing 5 to 8% of your round trip on that. Okay. So,
sorry, I took on a tangent there, but I'm just trying to avoid us. We talk about things like everybody knows it and maybe they don't. So, all right, so we've got a project out
in Australia, in South Australia, and that'll be going in next year. That's DC coupled. And the reason why I mention it is because we use that as a good example of dispatchable solar. So it is very possible to use flow batteries as a way of firming up your solar. And South Australia is a great market for that because they have a huge amount of solar, both rooftop and ground mount.
So in the middle of the day, power prices are really low because there's loads of solar and there's loads of sun because you're in Australia.
Exactly.
And so the idea is you put a battery on it and you can dispatch that power, you can sell it back to the grid when everybody actually needs it, which is at night when it's cold.
And you can displace coal.
Which is a big problem.
That's really, you're building solar to displace coal. And if you're building solar to displace solar, then it's not so useful. If you're building solar to displace coal, that's what we're all here for. So to answer your question, is it a silver bullet? No. I'm sorry. I should have said yes. Was the answer yes?
It's a bit of a clickbait question.
I think the answer is no because I don't. I wouldn't want it to kind of sit with one technology to be described as a silver bullet. I think we need to take a portfolio approach to this. I think the silver bullet to getting dispatchable solar is to make sure that all of these companies looking at storage technology or flexibility, low carbon flexibility technologies, are all appropriately funded and get a chance to build out demonstration and build out scale and show what they're capable of doing. That's the silver bullet. The technologies themselves, I've got full confidence that they work from an engineering perspective. It's just whether they can get over that sort of commercial chasm as such. It's kind of that, you go through your technology readiness levels and then how do you get into being really commercially deployed and the assistance to kind of get through that. Very much like Tesla's done in the last few years, that's the silver bullet, the support that they've received to get to become this kind of leading agent in kind of the EV world.
Okay, and all right, so I just want to talk about grid connections for a second.
Yes, I love grid connections.
Yeah, I know you love grid connections. And we didn't really have time to talk about this properly before. What's the idea here? You mentioned when we spoke about using storage to make the best of your grid connection.
Yeah.
And what do you mean by that? And what's the problem?
Yeah.
How big is the problem in the UK now?
Yeah, so to set the scene, and I'm going to borrow some figures from Aurora, other consultancies are available. And today we have grid connections sort of 110 gigawatts. That's sort of roughly right. To do the sort of 2035 net zero, we probably need to add something like 80 to 100 gigawatts of additional grid connections on top of that. To do the 2050 net zero, we probably need to get to somewhere around 300 gigawatts of grid connections.
Oh man.
So we're talking, So we're talking about every sort of grid connection that we've ever done. Huge. We're gonna not only double it, but then we're gonna do that again.
Really fast.
Yeah, and we're gonna do that all in 30 years. And if you think about the kind of nature of where those things are going, some of them are going offshore, okay. But there's also gonna be a number of sites that are gonna be built in the UK. I think one of the really valuable things that people hold today are grid connections. And so, and obviously from those stats, you can kind of see why. I think one of the things that we're not yet thinking about is how do you kind of squeeze the most out of that grid connection? So if you think about a standard solar site, you've got something that's sort of 10 to 15% load factor, maybe slightly more, maybe you've oversized it and you're getting a bit more through it.
Because at night there's no solar and therefore you're not really using a grid connection.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so I think you'll start to see business cases or business models where people say, actually, what's becoming really expensive is to get this grid connection, even in this kind of minded to position of kind of shallow grid connection costs that appears to be coming. But there is a world where those grid connections, I think, are going to become a very valuable thing. And the greater utilization of the existing grid connections is also going to be useful. And what that leads to is co-location. So do you want to put things onto sites that are effectively or relatively underutilizing their grid connection point? So, e.g. solar. Could you put solar and storage together? I think that works quite nicely.
So you get more bang for your buck for the size of the pipe that you're paying for. What's funny is these companies, DNOs particularly, but also National Grid, when they're deciding whether to offer you a grid connection when you put your application in, Their job is to keep the lights on, right?
Yeah.
And to not have blackouts. And so therefore, they are looking at across a 24-hour day, what could you do with that site?
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we're going to decide whether to give you a grid connection based on what you could do. Everything's worst case scenario.
Yeah.
Which means we have this very inefficient system that is poorly optimized.
Mm-hmm.
So what I really like about this idea is that it turns the how do we solve the net zero thing from a grid perspective into a how do we optimize the existing infrastructure rather than mm-hmm. how do we get more overhead lines and transformers and copper into the ground, which is basically the only solution if you want that much. So do you think there's going to be a space here for if you've got a solar site at the moment and you are considering putting storage on it, does this mean you can discount the cost of the storage relative to another site because you're going to be using an existing grid connection that you're kind of saving money from? Is this robbing Peter to pay Paul? I haven't really thought this through. Or is this actually better for your business case?
I think, you know, in terms of things like difficulty, it's a kind of hard thing to quantify. I think what you'll find is it'll start to come through in the commercial business case. So you'll start to see costs rising or alternatives being deployed in the market and it being a kind of more natural solution. So I don't think people will define it in terms of you know how hard it is to do. I think it'll become a more common solution and therefore you'll see sort of growth in that area. The other thing on that I would say is that it's really about how we use energy today and where we use energy today. And I think one of the big things on how we use energy today is if we do get to a world where everyone who owns an electric vehicle is happy to have smart charging tariffs and they're happy to be instructed to charge at certain times or to even, you know, vehicle to grid discharge at certain times, then we might not need that much flexibility. You know, we might have a lot of flexibility that's inbuilt within the system. So that's a really exciting thing and could change that whole connection problem. The other thing that's going on at the moment, I think, is this kind of locational problem. And we talked about this in the past, but there is a lot of, you know, we have a lot of wind up in Scotland, we have a lot of solar down in the south of England, and then the kind of CCGTs sit there today and they balance that out. And that is okay. The way that comes through in pricing for people sort of not so familiar with it is that those kind of locational actions in the balancing mechanism
system actions
are effectively,
which I guess for everybody is when National Grid in the balancing mechanism choose to accept bids and offers from generation or demand because they've got a constraint somewhere. So, mm-hmm. so the one that everyone talks about is the north-south, which is between Scotland and England. There's a couple of a large 400 kV lines and they have a thermal constraint. You can't send more power down than they can handle, and therefore what National Grid does is they do something called bidding down winds. They pay wind to switch off in Scotland, and then they often bring someone on in the Humber region, right? So that's one of the examples.
Yeah.
Just wanted to say, just in case.
And you've done a better job of explaining it than I was going to. But in terms of how those actions then get treated, so they get bundled up into something called BSUOS, which is balancing system, balancing use of system. Can't remember. Balancing use of system charges. Anyway,
we could choose to edit that so you look really clever, or we could put a really long pause in and just drag it out.
I think it might be balancing services system charges. Anyway, everyone.
There you go.
So the way that all of that is dealt with is the way that those sort of bids and offers for locational constraints are dealt with is through BSUOS.
Yep.
And BSUOS is essentially an averaged cost of taking all those actions, and then that is kind of allocated across consumers and generators. That to me is quite an ineffective way of encouraging people to be flexible, but also kind of locational with their flexibility. And I think there's a need to bring in more of that that locational pricing into the market, and that would allow people to place things like energy storage systems in better locations for National Grid, rather than relying on people to do locational modelling of balancing mechanism actions today, which I think is a very difficult thing to do. People are doing it, But wouldn't this all be easier if we had kind of
You're not supposed to, right? So you're not...
Semi-nodal pricing.
In your... here we go. Is it TCPC or TLPC? There's a something. Transmission constraint, license condition. So TCLC. There's a thing where you can't... if you're in a BM, you're a BSC party and you're in a BM, you're a BMU, so you're a balancing mechanism unit. Say I'm a pump storage unit in Scotland. I am not allowed to price up really negative, like I can't put minus £100 in all the time.
No.
Because there has to be an appropriate, I can't remember what the wording is, we'll have to get an expert in, but you have to justify your costs. So you have to show that your marginal cost is actually something like what you're putting. You can't game the system just because there's a constraint between the north and south.
Yeah.
Okay, that kind of makes sense, right? You don't want everyone gaming the system, abusing the system. But actually, that is the wrong way to see it because then you won't get storage built in the areas which are constrained. Because if people can't put in negative bids at, I don't know, someone's been investigated right now, it's like minus £60 in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't do that, then how do you encourage people to build sites where you actually need them?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I completely agree. We need something, locational pricing, nodal prices, something that encourages sensible locations of energy storage.
Yeah,
at the moment, there's not, right? It's all sort of pub chat. It's like, well, you sort of need it down south, you need it up north, and you need it because of X, Y, and Z. But there's no market mechanism to extract value from that.
And network connection costs should do some of it, and sort of transmission costs as well are trying to some extent. But I don't think it's clear enough considering the value that sort of the right storage in the right location could really bring. So I would call that out as something that could change. Just interesting around what you're talking about with that sort of price that you're able to achieve. The big difference between the sort of balancing mechanism units that are being dispatched in a pay as bid model versus the sometimes smaller systems being dispatched into what has been called near chasing or cash out, which is effectively a non balancing mechanism instructed action, but is a sort of an aggregation of all of the actions taken, and they're given one system price to act upon. That system price is pay as clear. So if it goes to £2,500, then they generate into that, then that's money for them. I mean, that might be a totally unfair, that might be a
well, fair's charged, isn't it?
But exactly. It might not be a representative cost of what they're actually buying their energy for, but you know that's how the system works. And so I can definitely see a sort of disparity in terms of how fair that is, but also. Yeah, whether it's encouraging us to build the right things in the right places.
So we've run out of time. We're going to leave the conversation there. We talked about a few things. We're going to put some links in the comments to what we talked about, maybe some dog photos, who knows. And then please like, comment, subscribe, share, and see you on the next one. Thanks, Ed, for coming in.
Thanks for having me.